Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and this is Literary Viewpoints, and we have a really, really, really stupendous show for you today. We have the author of one of my favorite series, a Paul Mangiarini series, and he's the author of Blood Flag, and it's Steve Martini, and he's here to tell you about it. So good morning, Steve. How you doing?
How are you, Fran? I'm good.
Hanging
good.
In there. How you doing? So tell us about Blood Flag and how you came to decide to write this particular book and the history behind it.
Well, I'm a nut when it comes to history and biographies. It's where I do most of my reading. I don't read a lot of fiction. The reason is I tend to pick up other authors' voices in my own writing, and you want to avoid that if you can. So I spend my time, and I'm a history buff anyway and a news junkie. And this book is heavily grounded in history. It goes back, the seeds of it go back more than 100 years, actually. And I don't know if you want me to talk a little bit about the beginnings of the book, but I'll talk a little bit about the First World War. That's where it really starts. And people don't realize how devastating that war was because it was followed by a Second World War. And the First World War changed many of the boundary lines on the globe, mostly in Europe, but also in Africa and Asia, where many of the Western powers or countries in the West had colonies. And in 1914, it started with the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie of Austria. And the assassination occurred in Sarajevo in the Balkans. And Austria declared war on the Serbs, on Serbia, because a young Serb had pulled the trigger. And the consequence was Germany jumped in under the Kaiser. And a world war erupted because of the overlapping treaties that existed at the time. You had the Allies and Germany and its allies basically facing off in Europe for what became a global conflict. That war wiped away many of the old empires that had existed and had ruled or governed the world for the better part of a century, in some cases two centuries, basically emasculated those old empires. The Kaiser was gone. He was sent into exile. And the consequence was the United States joined the war late on after American shipping had been involved, and then there was the XYZ affair. I won't get into too many of the small details, but basically the war ended with Germany being defeated, and many in the army and the military at that time felt that they had been stabbed in the back in Germany by politicians who sold out. In any event, one of these was a young man who had a twisted background. He'd never found anything that he did that he enjoyed in life, that he was good at particularly, and this was Adolf Hitler. And Hitler found a niche for himself in the army. It seemed that the spiked helmet and the uniform seemed to suit him well. And when the war was over, he was recovering from wounds, basically blindness. He had been gassed in the trenches. And it was temporary. He recovered, but the armistice came while he was still in the hospital. And he was very bitter, angry over what had happened. And at the end of the war, remained in the army. They didn't cashier him out. He didn't want to get out particularly. And he was used basically, as many of the young soldiers were at that time, basically to spy on political groups that were forming in Germany and were thought to be a threat to the then existing government. He was sent to look at a small political party called the German Workers' Party, and to report back to his superiors on their activities and to determine whether or not they were a threat to the regime. But instead, he went and decided that he liked the opportunity to delve into politics and started speaking before this group, and before long realized that he had a gift for speech, which he didn't know before that time. He had never really used these techniques. And over a period of time, basically took over that group. And it became the Nazi Party. Okay, so in effect, basically, this was the beginning of his political life. In doing so, he basically started coming up with a number of symbols that he would use with regard to the party. He withdrew from the army, and he designed a flag. That flag basically was the first, bore the first symbol of the swastika, and which Hitler had decided would be the symbol of his party. And it was a rudimentary flag, but fairly large, and there are pictures of it on the internet. In German, it was called the Blutfahne, blood flag. It became known as that because of an event that occurred in 1923. In 23, Hitler decided that he was tired waiting to assume power. He decided that he would follow in the footsteps of the Italian dictator Mussolini, who had basically seized power in a march on Rome. He decided that he would begin Hitler decided he would begin his march basically on in Munich, and he would go to a beer hall where the powers in that city basically were holding a political gathering. He would take hostage those leaders of the city and then march on city government. And he would take over that city and then basically move from there through Germany and seize power throughout Germany. It didn't work. They marched behind the what was to become the blood flag down the streets and got into a narrow corridor leading into a plaza, and the Munich police opened fire on them. And about 13 of his followers were killed. Hitler himself was not hit by any bullets, but was dragged to the ground by one of the men who was. His shoulder was dislocated. He ran. He hid for several days. He was ultimately captured by the police, tried. He was convicted of treason, but a very light sentence was imposed because he basically turned the trial into a show trial and gained the sympathy of many who sat on the bench at that time. And as a consequence, took the time to write Mein Kampf, his book. And the flag itself had fallen to the ground during the march, and one of his followers had fallen on it and bled out, hence the name the Blood Flag. That's where it comes from. So it is, in fact, a real object. They do know whose blood is on that flag. I thought when I saw this, it's a remarkable item of history for the simple reason that it's disappeared. No one knows what happened to it. It was kept in a building called the Brown House in Munich until the end of the war. The Brown House was bombed by the Allies from the air and destroyed, and the flag, the assembly of flags that were held there basically, many of them were destroyed. Some disappeared, taken as war relics by occupying forces. In this case, the United States Army, which ended up occupying Munich at the end of the war, a unit from Oklahoma City. And so therein lies the seeds of the story. The question is, was the flag destroyed? Was it taken as a war trophy, perhaps by soldiers who didn't know what it was, and brought back to the United States? Is it sitting in somebody's attic? All of these things play upon the reader, because they're questions that are asked in history, and no one really has the answers to them. So that's the seeds of the story, and that's where the idea came from.
It is very interesting, and I definitely have to tell you that I did look it up. Mm-hmm. I definitely did see a picture of it, because that's just me. And that's probably where some of those extra questions came from that I left out.
Right.
Because I have a habit of doing the research myself, and I'm going like, whoa, the picture of the flag is really quite compelling. And considering that I had a grandmother that was in the concentration camps in World War, I think it was World War One, no, World War Two, my grandmother was in the Polish concentration camp, was horrible. And, her story is going to be told very soon in one of my books.
I see.
I tell it from the point of view of the dead person behind the tombstone and what was done to her. And she told me, I don't know why she told, didn't tell anybody else, but I think maybe people need to hear it. This is important. That's why I was drawn to this particular book. So we've got the history of the blood flag, but we need to know about the man that's going to try to help the person that find it, or maybe not. And that would be Paul Mangiani, your main character, which you created. And you created him and his friendship with Harry Hines, which I loved. And then we come to the reason the book started with Emma. So give us a little bit of a background as to how he came to see this poor old elderly lady that just walked in and, my God.
Well, there's 14 books in the Modigliani series, so it goes back to the late 80s when Paul and Harry basically formed their partnership. And Harry is older, more cynical. He's a contrarian. If you say something, he'll usually argue with a point simply for the purpose of arguing with it. He's Dr. Watson to Sherlock in some respects. I try not to make Paul too Sherlockian, because you don't want to have a protagonist that doesn't have some flaws and make some mistakes and get waylaid by false leads from time to time. But in any event, Paul himself is a trial lawyer. He has had some mistakes in his life. He's had a lot of history through these books, but it's not necessary to read them in any particular order. Each book is a standalone novel per se, except for a trilogy that I wrote a few years back. But the 14 books, each one of them can be read alone. There's usually a little backgrounder in the beginning of the book that explains where they came from, where the practice started, how it started. It started in a fictional Western capital called Capital City, and then moved south to Coronado in San Diego County. And basically, this story opens with Emma Brower coming in, and she's an older woman. She's in her 60s, and or late 50s, I believe. In any event, her father has died recently, and he was in a nursing home. He was one of the veterans of World War II. He had fought in the Army and had been part of the 45th Infantry Division, which basically was located in Oklahoma City. And it was an Army Reserve unit, basically, back before the war. And it had a lot of its recruits basically taken from Indian tribes, Native American groups from that area. This was Indian territory. And as a consequence of that, there's some unique things that I hadn't anticipated when I started doing the research for the book. And sometimes you get lucky. And this had some twists and turns in it that even I couldn't anticipate or invent. But this group had as its shoulder insignia at one point before the war the swastika. Okay, it's the only Army unit that ever had a war swastika. And the reason for that was it was an ancient American Indian symbol. And so as a consequence, it was used for that that infantry division for a period of time until the War Department saw the war on the horizon, realized that this group would probably be going to Europe to fight. And as a consequence, they didn't want them going into battle wearing the insignia of the swastika. And Germany had already appropriated it, and they removed it from their shoulder insignia. And for several months, the unit had no insignia. And then they conducted a contest and basically came up with a Thunderbird, which was also an Indian symbol, and replaced the swastika with that. But this unit was remarkable in that it came up through southern France, basically, after D-Day, or about the same time as D-Day. And they fought their way into Europe and into Germany through the back door, basically. They merged or joined with the invading forces from the beaches of Normandy. And they were the group that liberated Dachau, the concentration camp at Dachau. And they then stormed into Germany and basically ended up in Munich at the end of the war. And so they were perfectly situated for them to basically stumble over or find the blood flag. And so I figured that was a good opportunity to propel this group or use characters from this group, all of whom are fictional. Brower, her father, none of these people are real. They're fictional characters that I created. But she basically is charged with a homicide, comes into Paul's office basically on referral from some other people that have known him. And in any event, she's charged with a homicide, but not first-degree murder at that point. In fact, they're unsure when she comes in exactly what she will be charged with, but they're pretty certain that she will be charged because her father died under somewhat questionable circumstances in a nursing home, and it's believed that someone killed him, perhaps not out of malice, but they believe the police anyway, the theory of the prosecution is that it was a mercy killing. He was in a lot of pain. He was very old. He couldn't recover. He was terminal. And the only one, he had an only child, it's Emma, and she came to visit him on a regular basis. So she she becomes the patsy, basically, for a charge of homicide or unlawful killing of a human being, simply because she was around. There's some other circumstantial evidence that basically ties her into the possible crime. And so they do ultimately charge her, and Paul takes the case. It's not a very compelling case when it starts out, but it becomes so a short time later when Paul sends one of his young assistants, a young woman who aspires to become a trial lawyer. And Paul has gained a certain affinity, as his wife has, for this young woman who's very aggressive, hardworking, very bright. He sends her to conduct, and I won't get into the details, but to conduct to go to Emma's house after she's arrested by the police to take care of an errand at the house that Emma couldn't deal with before she was arrested. And so she goes to the house, the young woman does, and she never comes back. They find her body 2 days later. And that becomes very much the propelling event of this story that forces Paul to find out who killed Robert Brower, okay, and who killed because he's starting to believe there's a connection between those two events and who killed his assistant at the home. So it's therein lies the story. And oftentimes you'll need, you take factual events, basically, and then you propel the story through a number of devices that you use. In this particular case, the young girl's name basically is Sadie Marie Leon, or Sophia, basically, is her, what everyone calls her. And Sophia is the driving force for Paul and Harry both to find the murderer in this case, because they suspect that whoever killed Robert Brower also killed Sophia.
Yeah, well, Sophia goes to her house, and she was made a target.
She was. And she got there at the wrong time.
He feels guilty about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So one of the questions on my page was, how come Israel was involved in this, too?
Well, because of the blood flag itself. The problem is, if you had a historic icon like this, the question would be, who would want the icon? Is it significant? Well, certainly it would be significant to collectors, okay? There are people who would probably pay vast sums of money for it, simply to put it in a museum or to hold it privately, okay? There would be hate groups who might want it, okay? There would be groups in the Middle East who might want to march behind it, such as ISIL, okay? And there are probably the Israelis and the Israeli government who, if they could get their hands on it, would destroy it, because they would simply not want this icon around. And the American government would be embarrassed if it were found on U.S. soil, is my guess. So there are a number of political groups, some of which are national in origin, who would have their own interest in trying to deal with this thing if they could dispose of it. And the Israelis would no doubt, I believe, be one of them. They're simply trying to sort out where it is, who has it. They would certainly not want to have it end up in the hands of hostile groups in the Middle East who might use it to rally around, that type of thing. So that's the reasoning or the justification for the Israeli connection to the flag.
I think people would probably want to see it in a museum just to see it, even though it
they might.
It's a horrible flag. Yeah, they probably would.
Mm-hmm.
He probably would. I don't think the Jewish Museum per se, but I definitely, think that the people would be, out of curiosity, if not alone, just to see it. And I'm sure the German government would love to get their hands on it.
to get rid of it, probably.
The sad part is that everybody fell for Hitler's propaganda and his charisma or whatever it was that he did, and the fact that so many people just bow down to him and all these people died because he said so. That's scary. That if, we need to keep our eyes open, because you never know when something like that could happen again. And there are places where it has.
Sure.
So the part that I found interesting, because my mother always told me before she died, she said, I became an educator and I taught for a long time. I'm a reading and writing specialist, and I was a dean. And before she got diagnosed with Alzheimer's, she wanted me to go back to law school, because she said, I have a big mouth and I know how to argue. Yeah, scary. probably could have. And I was supposed to be on jury duty in the Bronx, and the guy said, "No way, you're too smart." I go like, "Good, I'll go back to work and whatever." So how do you use your real life experience as a lawyer when you're explaining the bail hearings and the court experiences? Because it was so authentic, and you use Paul as the narrator for many of these experiences. So how come you write it that way?
Well, let me explain a little bit about that, because that's that has changed over the course of the series. Originally, when I started writing this book, or this series, it wasn't intended as a series. I wrote a standalone novel back in the early 90s, I guess, is when it was published, and that was Compelling Evidence. And it was it has become the first in the Modigliani series. It's where I created Paul and Harry and their entourage. Not the current group of people around them, because that has developed over a period of time and a number of books. But that's the seed basically of this series, and it was a very good book. The publisher, at G.P. Putnam and Sons, basically saw that novel and decided it was probably the best thing she'd read in about 5 months, and she had to have it, and so we went through a lot of gyrations. In any event, the book was ultimately sold to G.P. Putnam Sons, and they ran with it, and it did hit the New York Times bestsellers list. It's the book that broke me out. Okay, I'd written one novel before that, which had been published by a small publisher, D.I. Fine, in New York, and but hadn't found an audience, or much of an audience anyway. In any event, the publisher invited me back to New York. We went to dinner, and over the course of dinner, she said, "Can you do this again?" And I said, "Do what? Write another book? Certainly." And she said, "No, no, no. I want you to write another book with these characters." Well, I hadn't really even considered that. I was going to write standalone novels. That was my idea. And she said, "No, no, we can move you along much faster if you'll write a series with these characters." And I said, "Let me give it a try." And I did. And it was successful. It climbed higher and higher on the list with each successive book. We did three more books under contract at that time. And that was the genesis, really, of the Modigliani series. Let me go back, and maybe you can refresh my recollection with regard. Oh, the voice, the active voice. You see everything through Paul's eyes. That's the way the first book was written. And it was fine for one book, but as time went on and the series developed, it became confining. There were things I couldn't do because it was written in the first-person active voice. And as a consequence, the reader was basically looking through Paul's eyes as a camera at every event. And if Paul wasn't on stage in the book, the only way you could learn about something is through hearsay. Someone would tell Paul about it. Okay, well, that's not very entertaining. You have to show in a book rather than tell. In a novel, and so I changed the dynamic of the writing of the stories recently, actually about 7 or 8 books ago, I guess, maybe 7 books ago, halfway through the series. I decided to take these books and change the formula. I moved them partially, largely, I guess, outside the courtroom. Okay, I was feeling somewhat confined, although they still had a legal background. They were still clients coming in who sparked the story, basically. But the stories started being dealt with more in the investigatory stage of litigation rather than during the trial stage, although some of them actually went into the trials and ended short-circuited the trial so that they came to a conclusion before the trial ended. And I also started writing a third-person narrative. That is, when Paul wasn't present in a chapter, for example, I would write in the omniscient point of view so that the reader could actually see what was happening and could follow along. And in many cases, Paul didn't know what was happening. Things were happening outside of his vision, outside of his knowledge. And so he would become surprised at times. And the reader it was a good technique to use to draw suspense in the story. So basically, because the reader could see that he was, stepping into a landmine, a field of landmines. So, but he didn't know it. So in any event, I did change the method of writing and the style of writing and the point of view with regard to how the stories developed over time. But when Paul is present in a particular scene, you still see the events through his eyes. You get the internal monologue which is almost a film noir approach to telling the story. It's in the prose of Dashiell Hammett, basically. So you get to see a little bit of Paul delving, you know, sort of moving through the analysis of what he sees happening here. Sometimes it'll happen in dialogue. Sometimes it'll happen in internal monologue. So that's basically.
I just should tell you that I've read every single one of your books in the Paul Maggiani series. You were doing a book tour. I'm doing one also. A blog tour with Klotners and Crime. They're amazing. And
yes.
They just send me everything. I don't have to ask for anything. It's scary.
Yeah.
I get a personal email, Fran. We want you to do this, and I go, but I have 42 others from someplace else. You know, don't worry about it. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And even if I have read every one of them, and I said, okay, I got hooked on Paul Maggiani, and what happened was, I was on Amazon for some reason on my niece's birthday, and I was buying her, like, my niece is 8, and she wants she wanted books for her birthday, strange, as an 8-year-old.
Yes.
So I was buying her, like, I bought her, like, 50 books in a bag for her birthday. She's like, oh, my God, this is the best present. And I came across your book, The Blood Flag, and I go, like, why don't I have that?
Yeah.
And I got lucky that I was able to contact the right person, because it's hard sometimes, and go, like, why don't I have that? I don't do that too often. Usually it's just in the mail, and it just comes here.
Yes.
Like, you know, yesterday James Patterson's book showed up, and then Daniel Palmer will automatically send it. And I go, like, why didn't I have this one? This one was really good, and I read it in, like, less than 2 hours because it's an eye strain, and it was so good. So, Emma, what role does Emma play in the novel to help Paul find the answers that she needs? And what is her relationship with her father before he died? And she must have hated being in jail. I mean, after all, that's horrible for her.
Well, sure. It was awful for her. Paul feels her pain in that regard. And basically, she's a bit of a device, okay? She's the defendant, which you need in every criminal case, okay?
Mm.
Does she help him? Yeah, she gives him leads, okay? She explains a bit of the backstory here that Paul doesn't have. And that's the ultimate thread that Paul pulls on to start pursuing the story here after Sophia is murdered. She tells him, Emma tells Paul about a package that arrived at her father's house that contained a key. She saw the key. She said it was a very small key. There was also a piece of paper in this package that arrived. It came by post. And according to her father, it came from one of his army buddies. And that's all she knows about this, okay? But she does tell Paul that strange things started happening after that package arrived. Her father was very fearful. He was upset. He really didn't want the package, but he was told that they had an understanding, these army buddies, that as the package arrived, whoever received it would keep it. They wouldn't dispose of it. And shortly after this event, their house or his house was burglarized. Okay, someone came in, they tossed the house, they were looking for something, and she doesn't think they found it, but she suspects that they were looking for this key and whatever was on the little note in the package. And so Paul keys on that, and that becomes the thread that propels the chase, okay? And as we go on, we start to realize, and it doesn't take a lot of imagination in this regard, that the key is a key to a safe deposit box somewhere. It's unknown as to where that box is. But what's on the note is also uncertain, and Paul begins a search at the house to try and locate this, and she also is somewhat helpful in telling him where she thinks it might be. Okay, she knew her father, she knew his hiding places, she knew where he might have kept something like that, and she was fairly certain that whoever burglarized, well, she knows for a fact that whoever burglarized the house didn't find it. Because when they went back, her father checked, and the package or the contents were still there in the hiding place. So she believes she knows where it is. She gives Paul a hint. And after the disappearance of Sophia and the finding of her body in a body dump a few miles away, he and Harry go back to the house, and they basically they find the contents of the package, and but it doesn't really help them much because it's somewhat cryptic. It's like every other story in the series, and that is, it's like peeling an onion. You get a little lead, you tear the skin off the onion, and you see what's underneath, and then you work your way through the onion toward its core, and so it peels in that fashion. So every development in the story leads to something else. You keep pulling on the thread, and slowly the story begins to unravel. But then there are some wicked twists and turns in this book, probably more so than almost any other book I've written recently, anyway. As to, they're all pretty much whodunits, and this one has some wicked twists.
It sure does. There's a couple of really wicked twists, especially at the end. Whoa!
Mm-hmm.
And I said, like, okay, wasn't sure about that one. No, that was really good. But there were two more characters we have to talk about: Jocelyn and Herman. I love Herman.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And how does she come into this, and how does he come into this?
Okay, let me give you a little background on Jocelyn. Jocelyn Cole is a character from an earlier book. It was a standalone novel outside the series. All of the books I've written to date, and as well as the short stories and novellas, have all involved lawyers as protagonists. And you write about what you know. And Jocelyn basically had been a young lawyer who had worked in the Seattle area way back when, and in an earlier novel. And she basically had a love interest who was a young man who was involved in weapons of mass destruction. He was involved in a foundation, which later became known as the Gideon Foundation. And it was he was a bit of an idealist and sought to work in the area of nonproliferation with regard to weapons of mass destruction. He was killed in this story, and Jocelyn was at loose ends, basically, and she was left there. Well, I received a lot of letters over time and emails from readers saying, you know, when are you going to bring Jocelyn back? Jocelyn was such a great character, and I didn't quite know what to do, whether I should launch off on another series or how to work this. And ultimately what I did do is I brought Jocelyn together with Paul in one of the earlier books, and it worked. There was a chemistry there between these two characters, and they didn't hit it off initially. There was some friction because they're both very headstrong, and but ultimately it did, and it took a little bit of work to make it meld, but they became somewhat of a love interest, and that's where Jocelyn Cole comes from. She's also a lawyer. She's very bright. As you can see in this particular book, she actually resolves some of the conflicts and issues in the story that Paul doesn't see himself. And she's a very interesting character. Herman Diggs basically came about through a series of books. When I moved the story from the fictional capital city in Northern California, which would be a fictionalized Sacramento, where I had practiced law many years ago, south to San Diego, I decided that part of the reason for doing that was to gain the color background detail that was Mexico. I figured I could move some of the stories across the border and travel in that area, do research in that area, and draw the color of Mexico into the stories of the books. At that time, Mexico wasn't quite as dangerous a place as it is today, although the narco groups were still active down there, but they weren't doing some of the things they are now. And I did travel extensively in Mexico doing research. But in one of the earlier books, and I can't recall which one it was, basically I created Herman Diggs, who is a African American, a very large man, bald, shiny head, and he's a former college football player who basically lost an NFL contract because he blew his knee out in college in the last year of play in school, and so he had to find something else to do with his life, and he decided to turn toward security and private protection with regard to corporations and the like, and had some activities in Mexico, which is where Paul meets him for the first time is down in Mexico, and Herman basically saves his life, saves his bacon in one of the early stories, and they form an affinity and affection for one another. Herman ultimately comes north, crosses the border, ends up in San Diego out of work, and Paul decides to hire him as his private investigator, and therein lies the seeds of Herman Diggs, basically, and how he comes into the story. And he is basically the muscle in the story. If Paul needs to go to somebody who's active, who can move, who basically can deal with a threat, it's Herman, who's very resourceful. You've seen that in earlier books. He understands the underbelly of crime and can deal with it better than Harry and Paul. So he's the go-to guy if they get involved in trouble.
Yeah, he is. He's one of my favorite characters. And she's headstrong. And what I really loved was the fact that if Paul got out of line, she told him, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to see you. When you didn't see it my way, like, too bad. And yeah, that would be something I would do, seriously.
Uh-huh. Yes.
She's like, I know. That's right. She takes no guff from anybody. Are you
going
to bring his daughter back at all? Going to bring Sarah back?
It's possible. Yeah, it's very likely. I'll probably bring Sarah back in at some point in the future. Sarah was heavily... I drew on that character heavily in some of the earlier novels, particularly the trilogy that I wrote about Laquita. And Laquita was a dead bang, cold, stone cold killer. He was a wonderful
character.
Dark villain, yeah. And he's the kind of villain. There's something about it when you have someone that malicious, but he does things with a certain sense of humor, gallows humor. He was involved with the narco trade in Mexico, and Paul got crosswise with him in one of the early stories in the trilogy, and so there was bad blood between the two of them, and Laquita basically sends Paul and Harry into hiding because he basically has a contract out on them to kill them, and Sarah is involved in those stories, and she gets dragged away from her own life. Here's a young woman; she's college age at the time these stories developed, and so she's a little angry at her dad for disrupting her life. She doesn't see the danger initially, as many young people don't. They think they're immortal, and nothing would involve them. But she's a target, obviously, because she's his kin, and Laquita knows of her. He knows her background. He knows that Paul has a daughter, and he would seize that daughter and hold her for ransom, if nothing else, if not kill her, simply for revenge. In any event, so they all are forced into hiding, and Sarah doesn't really forgive her dad very easily for this. It's disrupted her early life, and the consequence is that she needed a respite from these stories. She moves north to Los Angeles for a period of time, and that's where we find her when the blood flag opens. And for, I think, one book before that, she has somewhat disappeared from the stories, but she'll no doubt come back in at some point.
That would be really good, but I know she decided that she wanted to get out of the safe house, so she goes and takes a walk and goes out to run, and that was a dangerous job. See, I do remember everything. Scary.
Exactly. Yes.
I told you I read all of them.
Yes, you have.
And once I read the first one, I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was in big trouble. Because I couldn't put the rest of them down, and I did review every single one of them, including the blood flag, which I will post later.
Wonderful.
My brilliance will be out there. Yeah, so I tell you, you know what's really scary is that everybody reads it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They read. I put it on Just Reviews, whatever, and then I read them. And what's really great about, like I said, Partners in Crime is they read your books.
Yes.
They do not just do a blog tour. They actually read the book before they put it out. And I'm very proud to say that starting June 13th, I'm doing one, too, for my next book, my last
wonderful.
Book.
Yeah.
Hidden Truths and Lies came out April 7th. It's the fourth in the Faces Behind the Stone series, and the stories are told from the point of view of the dead person behind the stone that did something wrong or just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. So it's my first four are like that, and the last two are my attempt at sci-fi, and it must have been right because great, because Simon Chavez and Vincent Zandri both gave me blurbs for the back cover, as well as two other people. So, yeah, I was like, oh, my God, this is great. So I'm writing another one. I'm going to kill off anybody that, you know, has a problem. Let me know, because we know we just get rid of them in my book. It makes it so much easier.
Yes.
And before I forget, When Shadows Come, Vincent Zandri, next Thursday, June 2nd, 10 o'clock, be there. A new author, Robin Yoakum, A Brilliant Death, based on a true story of a missing mother. and what happens when her son decides she wants to find out the truth. That was really good. And on June 15th, my last one until after the summer, because I need to take a break, Daughter's Dream, Shelley Shepherd Gray. I read that in, like, it was absolutely fantastic story. And before I really forget, I'd like to dedicate this show, since we're talking about the Blood Flag and since we're talking about Germany and the war, I'd like to dedicate this show to the memory of my grandmother, Katie Goldberg, who lived it. And that's, I think, what really drew me to this, is that my grandmother suffered in the concentration camp, and this story really brings it out, so I'm glad I read it. So let's continue on. We have about another 10 minutes. How, when you decided on the villain for this one, we're not going to say who, how did you create the villain to sort of trick readers into thinking the person was good?
Oh, I don't want to go there.
Okay. Well, how do you create,
no,
how
would,
do you create your
would,
villain?
Yeah.
How do you create your villains for your story? Because
well,
this guy,
villains,
whoa.
Yeah. The villains are often the fun people to create. I don't know why. Maybe I've got a dark side to me. But when I created Laquita, the Mexican killer, for the trilogy, basically, he took on a life of his own. And he seemed to propel the stories. Whenever there's a couple of rules in fiction. Patterson put out a list of 10 rules at one point. And as you know, he writes books with, in collaboration with others. And, his 10 rules, one of them is when things begin to sag, kill somebody. Okay. So in,
yeah,
com-
he
in
did
commercial
that
fiction,
in the Murder Club, he killed off Jewel.
Yeah.
How dare he do that?
Yeah.
Yeah. He
yeah.
did that.
It, yeah. And
that's
so,
not good.
And that's well, it disappoints some readers, but it does you know, pick up a lagging story from time to time. Well, when you have a dark character like Laquita, okay, the Mexican killer, basically it does give you that opportunity. If you get involved in a section of the book that's a lot of talking heads and analysis of evidence and things like that, sometimes you start to lose the reader. They begin to yawn or their eyes start to droop. You want to go back and do a cutaway to a scene involving Laquita where he's got somebody basically in his sights and he's zeroing in on them. That starts to gin up the suspense and make the story taut again. So it's a matter of using your villain basically in ways that the reader can't see. Okay, they can't see it coming, and sometimes you don't even see that this individual is a villain. Okay, and so you see them doing certain things, carrying out certain activities, and you don't realize that what they're doing has a dark seam to it here. So I want to be very careful on this story, talking too much about villains and who did what to who, for the simple reason that I think it does come, it catches them between the eyes at some point in the story as to what really happened here. It's also the thing that you can do. See, if Paul were involved in a first person narrative, and that was the only point of view that you had telling a story, some of the devices that are used in this particular book, Blood Flag, could not be used effectively, okay? Because Paul would see it. And because Paul see it, the reader would know it, okay? It wouldn't be fair, for example, to have Paul see something and withhold that information from the reader. Now, it has been done in books before, but there are some people who will claim that, you know, when you do that, when you hide something from a reader through the entirety of a story, and it's the most propelling issue in a story, okay, it's what drives the protagonist to pursue someone, okay? The Odessa File is an excellent example of that. You've got a problem, okay? In the Odessa File, we have an individual who is propelled to chase this this aging Nazi after the war, okay? And we don't really know why, other than the fact that this individual is evil, okay? The man who he's chasing, and the protagonist who is chasing him is a newspaper reporter, and so we think he's after a good scoop, he's after a good story, he's after the fact that that a man recognized him from a concentration camp, and he was the commandant of that concentration camp, the evil villain, the man they're chasing. And And so he wants justice. Okay, well, he wants a whole lot more than justice, because the author is withholding a critical fact from the reader until the very closing scene, in the ultimate solution. And the fact is that there was a confrontation at a train station where prisoners heading to a concentration camp were being transferred, and there was a confrontation between this evil villain who he's pursuing and the reporter's own father, who was in the German army at the time. And these two men fought the villain and his father, and the villain shot and killed his father, but we don't learn that until very late in the story. Therein lies the problem. If Paul withheld that information, you'd have readers basically throwing the book across the room at the end. But by being able to break away from the first-person narrative and to show things in the third-person narrative, you can do all kinds of things that are outside of Paul's knowledge and therefore outside of the reader's knowledge. And you can slowly develop them. You can drop clues. You can give hints. You can do all kinds of things. And if the reader doesn't pick up on those clues or those hints, then they should have read more carefully.
This is very true, but then there's me. I get it all the time. They tell me I haven't missed one yet, which is really good. Mm-hmm. And right now I'm working on one that I'm hoping I don't miss. It's a business book. These are not my forte.
Sure.
But I'm reading it anyway. I try.
Sure. Yeah.
It's The Focused Decision Maker was written by Terry Bresnik. I grew up with him. He sent it. I do understand where he's coming from. I'm just trying to figure out how to write a review and not, you know, bore people while they're reading it. So I'm trying to come up with my little humor in the thing. What can I say? So would you ever kill off any of my favorite characters? I mean, John Lescroix killed off one of my favorite characters in one of his books, and I was like, I said, you cannot kill off this person ever.
Generally, I don't. I did kill off one character. It was at the behest of a publisher, actually. And it was Nikki. It was Paul's wife, okay? And what happened was the relationship was headed nowhere. I had no idea what I was going to do. When I started the book, like as I said, it was a standalone novel. Mm-hmm. And the devices in that first book, I wasn't considering a series, were that Paul was married, okay? Not only was he married, but he had violated his marriage vows because he had an affair with another woman. And that woman turns out to be charged with a murder, okay? He ends up defending her without disclosing to anyone the fact that they'd had a relationship. And so, therein lies the problem for Paul. As that information becomes known, he's going to become tainted as the defense lawyer. She's going to be in jeopardy as a consequence. So it heightens the threats in the story. Well, all of that was the setup for this first novel. It was supposed to conclude, and that would be the end of it. Well, when she said, can you write a series, I hadn't considered the ramifications of the fact that I had a protagonist who was already married, which somewhat limited. I mean, not necessarily. It depends how you develop a marital relationship. I guess The Thin Man did it very, very well, where you had a husband and wife, and they retained the romance in their relationship. You know, sometimes he got a wandering eye, but he never got serious about it, and they drank a lot. But you know, all of those devices were somewhat canned. They were used. So what do you do in this relationship to keep it fresh, okay, for each story, okay? In any event, she decided, the publisher at that time, the CEO of Putnam, it was Phyllis Grand, and she decided that, you know, something had to happen. You know, they either had to get divorced or Nikki had to die. And he said, you know, she said, you can kill her off and use her in the next book, you know, and Paul can try and find out who killed her, or maybe he's charged with her murder. In any event, I didn't want to go that route, so I decided she died of natural causes. But that's the only time I've ever really killed off one of the principal characters in my stories. I did kill a principal character, a love interest in my first novel, Simeon Chamber, way back when. But again, that was a standalone novel.
Well, you can't kill off Jocelyn, and I'm not going to ask if they're going to wind up together, because it's more fun this way to watch it. See,
yes, I think it
stay
is.
Together.
Yeah.
I see. I'm telling you, this is good. I got a handle on this one. Before we end, what's next for my favorite character, Paul Mangiani, and when am I getting it?
Well, I'm on a contract to finish two more books, actually.
Oh, good.
One a year. The deadline to deliver this next manuscript is September 1st. I hope to meet that deadline. I've had a few health issues, which have slowed me down, but I don't think they're serious in any event. So the next story basically deals with, this is true of a lot of the books that I've written, and that is ideas germinate for a period of years. They sit on a list in a computer, and at some point in time, they either mellow or they turn sour. And this particular one deals with science. It deals with a lot of the medical medical breakthroughs that we've been seeing. I mean, people are talking about a generation at some point in time that will live almost forever because of genetics and genetic engineering. They're thinking that perhaps children born today may live well into their hundreds. We'll see. It may be science fiction, but. It is, but it also carries a downside. There's always a dark seam to every blessing, and that is that what do you do about overpopulation? Who gets the necessary medications that will allow you to sustain life for that period of time? What kind of ethical decisions are going to have to be made? What kind of economic decisions are going to have to be made? It raises all of those ugly concerns. So therein lies the seeds of the next story. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That is so definitely me. That is definitely a Fran book, without a doubt.
Yes.
I remember Kara Pequot, when I've got to email her, I was writing something. When my sister had a heart attack before she died, they tried to bring her back, but they said that after a person passes away, within 8 hours they can bring them back if they're not totally brain dead somehow.
Yes.
And she was writing something about that, and I never got it. And I read something in a science article last week about that also. And I'm going like, why couldn't they save my sister? They couldn't.
Yes.
And
yes.
To be very honest, we never really found out what happened. We never really found out the cause of her heart attack or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So books like that are seriously, seriously interesting. So tell everyone where we can find out more about Steve Martini and your books and all the ones that I've read, every one of them.
Sure. You can find the books in any bookstore. They're out in paperback. They're out in hardcover. The hardcovers usually run their course in about a year. In terms of, you can go to Kindle. All of my books are in ebook format now, so you can order them online and have them sent to you through the internet. You can usually get them within a minute or two, downloaded into your readers. And you can get the entire list of books by going to my website, and that's stevemartini.com. That is Steve Martini, just like the cocktail.com. And it will list the entire list of books. It'll give you a synopsis of each story, tell you the order in which they were written, a little background about me, where I was born, where I came from, and what I've been doing for the last quarter of a century now, and a little bit about my early career as a lawyer, as a newspaper reporter, and the like. But it's stevemartini.com.
Well, for those people that don't know, just start from the beginning and get them all.
And
considering that Father's Day is just like 2 weeks away, or three, great present, people, seriously. Box set, buy them all. I mean, to me, the best present in the whole world is a book. I can't help it. That's just me. It is. It's the best present in the whole world is a book. And today would have been my aunt's 99th birthday, my Aunt Tova Ross. And she's the reason why I became a reading and writing staff developer and educator, because at 3 years old she said, you can read, you can write, and you get what the book is about. And she didn't know how I did it. I still don't know how I do it, but I do it. So she encouraged me, and she would have been 99 today. So happy birthday, Yvette. And if not for her indoctrinating me and standing in front of her when I was three saying, you will be an educator, you will be a reading educator like me, I think I would have done it anyway, because my mom made me read 10 books a week, so it didn't matter. So for those of you that don't know what to get, I would go online and just buy every one of Steve's books and give them for Father's Day presents. Better yet, read them for yourself and buy another set, which would probably be better.
That's wonderful.
Thank you so very, very much. I hope you feel better.
I'm sure I will.
You will, and stay away from the things you're not supposed to eat. Thank you so much, and please make sure I get the next one.
I will. Okay. Take care, Fran.
Have a nice day.
Bye-bye.